Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Maria Clave, distinguished, celebrated, world-renowned computer scientist, president of HMC, board director, Microsoft Corporation, speaker at the World CIO Forum, past dean of engineering, professor of computer science at Princeton University, former vice president and dean of science at UBC in Canada. Maria, you have a very distinguished and long history of considerable outstanding contributions in so many fields, including societal causes. And I'm very appreciative that you're coming in today to share all of your experiences with the audience. So thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Stephen.
Now, Maria, can you profile the World CIO Forum, or WCF, and your role with the WCF?
So the World CIO Forum is going to be held at the beginning of November in Shenzhen in China. And I'm going to be giving a keynote there, and I'm going to be talking about how we attract, retain, and advance more women as information technology professionals. And I'm really looking forward to this opportunity because I think there's a lot of you know, there aren't a lot of women in as computing professionals, and I think there's a lot we can do to change this. And I think it's a tremendous opportunity to get the word out to CIOs around the world.
Now, in your view, why should CIOs, senior executives, government, and industry leaders participate in the World CIO Forum?
I think it's an amazing opportunity, the first time ever, as I understand, for CIOs and other senior executives, government officials and so on, to really get together and discuss what's going on around the world in the transformations in information technology. And I think the pace of change is faster now than it's ever been before. For example, the move to cloud services, software as a service, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service. The fact that consumer IT is having an increasing impact on what happens in industry as people are bringing their own choices of phones and tablets and laptops to work. And then, you know, I also think it's a very interesting time in terms of career development for IT professionals. And so I think this is an opportunity for leaders from around the world to really get together and share insights. It's also a wonderful opportunity for networking. And one of the things I've learned in my life is there is probably almost nothing more important than getting to know the people who can help you leverage what you're doing.
So what do you hope to accomplish at the WCF?
Well, the very first one is, of course, this issue about women in computing and in information technology. I often have the feeling when I'm talking with technology executives that they've just sort of thrown up their hands and said, you know, we can't change this. And it's just not the case. And I'll talk a little bit later on about some of the things we've been doing at Harvey Mudd College in terms of increasing the participation of females in computer science. And it's very clear that if you want to change it, you can change it. So that's the first one. The second one is, you know, the really big thing I'm on these days as president of Harvey Mudd College is raising people's awareness of what an amazing institution we are. And so, of course, it's a great chance to do that. And then third, and perhaps the most important, is networking, networking, networking.
I like that, networking, networking, networking. Now, here's a bit of a sort of an oddball question, perhaps, but I know you attend a lot of conferences, and there's typically a senior executive or some kind of leader who's providing the keynote. So if you were to hold some kind of a conference, who would be on your short list of recommendations as an opening keynote?
Well, you know, I mean, there's some absolutely not surprising possibilities. I mean, obviously, Steve Jobs, I think, has done some truly extraordinary things in the last couple of decades, and he's also a great speaker, so that would be a wonderful opportunity. I'm not sure, given his current health situation, that that's feasible. I also think Bill Gates is pretty amazing. We just had Bill Gates visit Harvey Mudd College, and he was actually, you know, talking as much about what he's doing with his foundation as about technology issues, but again, somebody who's, you know, very insightful, very smart. And then you could go for, you know, someone like, you know, obviously a Mark Zuckerberg, who has created something that is really quite amazing, or for the COO of Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg, who again is doing some amazing things there. Another person I might choose would be somebody like Paul Moritz, who as CEO of VMware has just scaled that organization up incredibly, or the founder of VMware, Diane Greene. So, you know, I think there are lots of different possibilities. They all bring different perspectives. And, you know, I think we are living through the age. I mean, I don't mean this decade. I mean this sort of like half century of when information technology is truly transforming the world. And so there are just, you know, there are just lots of people who have had a vision and have been able to execute and literally have had just a huge change on the human to the human experience.
You know, that's interesting. You know, you mentioned Bill Gates speaking at Harvey Mudd, and I know Bill's schedule is very, very busy. So how were you able to achieve that?
Well, when I was first interviewed by Bill about going on the board of Microsoft, I said to him, you know, one of the deals is that if I go on the board of Microsoft, you have to come visit Harvey Mudd College. So he agreed at that point, and it took 2 years for it to happen because of how busy his schedule is, but it was a fabulous visit. And, you know, I think there was more excitement about the time students and faculty got to spend with Bill, and also about the interview that we did to an audience, a present audience of over 2,000, but I think, you know, watched by many, many more people on the web. So it was worth the wait.
Well, that's amazing. Now, in late March, there's noted computing pioneer Kelly Gottlieb, and he gave a very special lecture at the University of Toronto on his 90th birthday, which was followed by a reception and dinner in honor of this sort of giant or icon in computing. Now, you've known Kelly for many years. Can you maybe share a story or two about this legendary pioneer?
Well, what's sort of hard to believe now is that when I first met Kelly, he was younger. I believe he was 58 or maybe even 57 than I am today. I'm going to turn 60 this summer. And so, you know, it's hard for me to believe that I'm now older than he was when we first met. And of course, when we first met when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto, and he was, even in those days, this is 1978, widely recognized as the father of computing in Canada and, you know, sort of a minor god figure. And I later, you know, really got to know Kelly really very well in my role, various roles with the Association of Computing Machinery. I was, first of all, on the council, and then a vice president, then the president, then the past president. And for well over a decade, probably longer than that, Kelly chaired the awards committee for ACM. And, you know, I ended up going on the Turing Award selection committee for 5 years. And, you know, one of the things I think about the ACM awards is there's this wonderful awards committee chaired by Kelly, now co-chaired by Jim Horning. And, you know, the wisdom of Kelly is really quite amazing in terms of the decisions that have been made over time in terms of, for instance, elevating the importance of the Turing Award and, you know, thinking about how that should be awarded and be on the committee and all those kinds of things. So, you know, I feel like when I first got to know him, I was just a kid and he was the father of computing. And now I'm an old person and he's still the father of computing in Canada.
Oh, I just love those stories there. So now, really something really interesting. You are nominated to the Broadcom board. Now, can you describe the experience, process, insights, and outcomes from this latest honor?
Well, first of all, I'm not elected yet. So the proxy went out, was filed with the SEC earlier this week. So I'm not actually on it, but I've been through the process of being interviewed and had the board vote, and hopefully the shareholders will also vote in favor. So Broadcom, as I think probably most people know, is a semiconductor company that specializes in chips for communication. And they're one of the two leading tech companies in Southern California, the other one being Qualcomm. And I have to admit that when I was contacted, I had, you know, I had no idea they were, that, you know, that they were interested in me. And of course, it turns out that a number of technology companies are interested in having a university president or a college president on their board because they're interested in the connection with education and research that goes on in colleges and universities. And when the search consultant first called me, he told me that he talked to a few college presidents, and none of them seemed that interested in industry. And when I told him that I had co-founded a startup, and had been on, of course, the board of that one and of another one, and, you know, he was just sort of like, oh, my goodness, there are people who are interested in companies and technology and so on. And so then I had the opportunity to meet the CEO, and I had already met the CTO once before, Henry Samueli, and got to spend some more time with him, and then spent time with several of the board members. And, you know, one of the things I love about doing in life is to find a group of people who have sort of shared interest in making a difference in the world. And Broadcom is certainly one of those companies, and Scott McGregor, the CEO, is amazing. But so are the members of the board. I mean, they're just, to a person, really interesting, energetic, wise people. And I know I'm going to learn an enormous amount if I do join the board. So I'm really thrilled with this opportunity.
I'm sort of fascinated with this idea that, other college presidents aren't sort of really feeling, wanting to be connected with industry. That just kind of surprises me.
I just think it depends on your background. And so I'm obviously a computer scientist. I'm interested in hardware as well as software. Perhaps if you're somebody who's in biomedical research, it's not as interesting. You know, you might be interested in being connected with a different kind of company.
Or as you indicated earlier, though, it's just the tremendous opportunities to learn from others who are very skilled and have such great histories, or the great opportunity to network.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, the last time we chatted, you were invited to the Microsoft Board of Directors, and you are now sitting on the board. Can you describe your experiences as a functioning board director?
So the first thing I've got to say is one of the best learning opportunities of my life ever. Obviously Microsoft is a very large and very diverse company in the sense that it has many different businesses that are succeed at the $1 billion or tens of billions of dollars per year in revenue level. It's a company with an enormous amount of talent. It's a company that is facing, obviously, challenges on many fronts. You look at the iPhone and the iPad and their success, and then you look at Google and their efforts with Google Docs and also with Android. You look at the efforts from many areas to produce more successful browsers than Internet Explorer. You look at the competition in, the enterprise resource planning kinds of areas. I mean, it's just, you can sort of, like, look in any direction and you can find some very, very good companies competing with Microsoft. So it's a very interesting time. I find the quality of people in the company really extraordinary, and I also find the quality of people on the board extraordinary. And so I feel like I'm taking a crash course in learning about IT, the IT industry broadly conceived, and I'm also taking a crash course in learning about how to be, a good director of a corporate board. So I've been very lucky in that I've had, I feel like I have many people giving me very good advice, and I'm enjoying it enormously.
So then how would your board positions impact your many roles into the future, and can you provide specific examples?
Well, a great example is that I had the good fortune to meet with Chris Cookson, who's vice president at Sony Pictures, and who is in charge of essentially taking the whole process from filming a movie through distributing the final movie to all of the places that movies get distributed these days, and making the whole thing a seamless digital process, working on files the whole way through. And, to somebody in the IT industry, this seems sort of obvious that this is what should happen. But the reality in most places is that there's just so many different formats along the way. And, it's sort of like you upload a tape, you do some kind of digital processing on it, you copy it back to tape, goes back to someplace else, and then it gets sent to the next person who's going to load it into a digital file in a different format, do something to it, et cetera, et cetera. And, I think one of the things about being on the Microsoft board is one of the discussions that was going on was about how really, in many ways, distribution should be a cloud service. And, if I hadn't spent the last 2 years on the Microsoft board, I don't think I would have anywhere near this perspective on how important cloud computing is, what the issues are, all of those kinds of things. And so it meant that I could have a conversation with the folks at Sony Pictures about, what their challenges are, what they're trying to do in a much more informed way. And, of course, as president of Harvey Mudd College, which is a science and engineering college, and where we're really trying hard to provide the best undergraduate education in science and engineering that the world needs today, being able to understand what the challenges are in an area like the motion picture industry, which is going through this huge transformation to digitization, and, bringing to it a much broader business perspective than I would normally have as a college president, I think has made a lot of difference. And that's, of course, true for virtually any conversation I have with a technology executive anywhere. So that's the first thing, is just that I'm much better informed. And, it really helps me understand applications of science and engineering in industry in ways that I wouldn't normally have been able to do. The second one is it opens doors. I mean, there's just no question that as a member of the board of Microsoft, people are more interested in talking to me. I can't imagine why, but it's true. And then the third one is that obviously once you're on, a major corporate board like Microsoft, you become visible as a potential board member for other companies. Now, I'm, very cautious about how I spend my time, in the sense that I know that my absolutely number one responsibility is to Harvey Mudd College. But also, if I go on a board, I want to make sure that I'm actually going to be a highly functioning and hopefully effective board member for that institution as well. And so, even in deciding to go on the Broadcom board, I will be stepping down from another board that I've been on for 14 years, and that's a painful decision, but I feel good about it because that organization is doing phenomenally well. And, I'm a big believer that you shouldn't stay on boards for too long, and I've been on since the organization founded. So it's sad, but I know they're going to be just fine.
Is there sort of a communication challenge when you sit on large corporate boards in terms of sensitivity of the messaging and so on? Is that something that creates concern at all? Or?
Well, I think you have a responsibility not to talk about a lot of things. I mean, there's absolutely no question that, you're privy to a lot of confidential information, and it's just really important that you not share that. So I would say that is the biggest thing. I'm a big believer in using the products of the organizations that you're involved with. And so, for instance, I'm using a Windows Phone 7. I could use an iPhone if I wanted to. I did buy an iPhone for my husband for his birthday 3 years ago. You certainly have a responsibility to, as a board member, in terms of, not revealing information, but I think you're expected to be, honest about what you're doing to the extent that you're allowed to talk about things.
Now, let's turn our attention to HMC, Harvey Mudd College. You're well into your college presidency. Now, what are the most urgent issues that you're dealing with?
Well, thank you for asking. I'm about three-quarters of the way through my fifth year, and about 2 months ago I signed a contract to do another 5 years here, so I think you can tell that I really like being here. In terms of urgent issues, the first thing I would say is that Harvey Mudd College is, things are going extraordinarily well. I cannot even begin to tell you all the amazing things that have happened in the last 4.5 years, but, just to give you a few, our number of applications to Harvey Mudd College is up over 50% from when I arrived. We had our first incoming class that was gender balanced last year, and it will be again this year. We are about to break ground for a fabulous new teaching and learning building that will be the first building on the campus that is not built of concrete blocks, and we're replacing a 9,000-square-foot building with a 70,000-square-foot building. So, it's a really wonderful time to be here. However, we, of course, have challenges. So the three I would mention are we're just not well enough known. I mean, I say all the time, if you've heard of Caltech or heard of MIT, you should have heard of Harvey Mudd College. Now, you might wonder why it matters about visibility. And the main reason, it's not that we need more applications. It's that for some groups of possible students, it matters how visible the institution that they're going is. So, for example, if you are the first student in your college and you are admitted to Harvey Mudd College, Caltech, and MIT, almost certainly you will pick the ones that are better known because, you're making this huge investment and you want to make sure you have the opportunity to go to a place that is going to be worth that investment. Similarly, for students from underrepresented minority groups, African Americans and Hispanic students, again, they're much more likely to go to a better-known institution. So if we want to attract those students, we simply have to be more visible. The second thing is it's expensive to provide the kind of education that Harvey Mudd College does. We have between 8 students and 9 students to 1 faculty ratio, student-to-faculty ratio, and our faculty spend enormous amounts of time with our students. And so the second challenge is I constantly have to be out there raising resources. Again, I would focus on the diversity of our student body. We have come an enormous way with respect to gender. We have have a lot more to do in terms of attracting more international students, Native American students, African American, and Hispanic students as well. So those are the things that we're focusing on. But, you know, the thing I have to say is, and I can really take almost no credit for this because our faculty and students and staff are just amazing, but we are doing extremely well.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you're discussing like MIT, Caltech, and I know Harvey Mudd, it's just you're a top-ranked school. How does that impact the visibility, impact fundraising and things like that?
I think it has a big impact on fundraising because, the places that raise the most money are the places that actually have the most money and who are the best known. So, for example, Harvard and Princeton, Stanford, MIT, Caltech, they're all incredibly successful in raising money. Now, to a certain extent, for example, for Harvard and Princeton and Stanford, almost all of the money is coming from their alumni. Now, we have less than 6,000 alumni, and the average age is 36. And so, you know, when you're 36, most 36-year-olds have not made $1 billion or even $1 million. And so if we really are going to be successful in raising the resources, we have to be good at convincing philanthropists who love science and engineering and mathematics education that they should invest in Harvey Mudd College. And it's for those philanthropists, if they're not an alum of MIT or Caltech, they're still more likely to give to MIT and Caltech than Harvey Mudd College simply because they're better known. And so these two things go hand in hand. And, you know, I can tell you our visibility has increased enormously in the last 4.5 years. But we're not done yet. And, you know, we also have been doing quite well in fundraising, but we're only at the very beginning of that.
Now, how are you making further inroads with HMC? Can you spotlight 3 success stories?
Well, first of all, I want to emphasize this is not me doing anything. This is the Harvey Mudd College community, because everything that has been done it's really an incredible labor of love and inspiration from the entire community. So the first one I want to talk about is our computer science department. The year before I arrived, and this had been the case for several years, the percentage of females in the computer science major was about 10%. So 90% male, 10% female. And that is not unusual. That is pretty much par for the course at the top institutions in the United States. And our computer science department decided that they wanted to work on this. And I'm delighted to report that as of this year, the percentage of CS majors who are females, 42%, exactly the same as the percentage of the overall student body at Harvey Mudd College. And the department did this. They did a number of things, but I think the most important pieces are, the first thing is that they changed the introductory course from one that was a pretty standard learning to program in Java experience to one that really focused on problem solving using a computational approach for problems in science and engineering, with lots of opportunities to work in teams using Python as the programming language. And it has just been a huge success. It's really, every student takes a computer science course in their first semester, and of the courses that our students take in the first semester here, that computer science course seems to be the most popular of all, and it certainly wasn't beforehand. They also did a fair amount to get rid of what I would call the macho effect. So the macho effect is, in introductory computer science courses, there are often a certain number of students, mostly male, who've been programming since a young age. And they arrive in that course feeling that, wanting to show people how much they know. And it's very discouraging for people who've had little or no experience before. And so the computer science department separated the introductory course into essentially 3 sections. One for little or no experience, called CS Gold, CS5 Gold. Our colors are black and gold, so you'll understand this. CS5 Gold is for little or no experience. CS5 Black is for some experience. And then CS42 is for students with a lot of experience. And in that course, they will actually complete enough so that they don't have to take the next course in the sequence, which is CS60. And by streaming in this way, they were able to make it a really good experience for each of those groups of students. The next thing they did was decide to take first-year female students, independent of major, to the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. This is a conference that's held every fall. It will be in Portland in November this year, and it will have probably a couple of thousand attendees, of whom 95% will be female. And it will be everything from high school students through the most senior women in the IT and computing professions. And it's just an amazing experience. So if, you know, if you haven't been, you really should go. It is just, for both males and females, that is a transformational experience. And what they found was that for the students who attended the conference is that they came back having a level of confidence about their ability to succeed, whether it's in physics or engineering or computer science. But they also came back understanding how broad the impact of computer science is in today's world. And so last year we took 36 of our incoming first-year students to the Hopper Conference, which was in Atlanta, and this year I'm sure we'll take even more than that. And it's just been a wonderful experience for the students that go and also for the faculty that go with them. Then finally, one of the things we know is that an early research experience is very important in motivating students. And so they have been offering summer research opportunities to students at the end of their first year, so in the summer between the first and second year, and they have made sure that at least half of those go to female students. And so the combination of these have resulted not just on there being a lot more female CS majors, there are a lot more students of both genders who are taking more high-level CS courses even if they're not majoring in it, and also the number of majors overall has gone up substantially. So I call this the 10 to 42% story, and, you know, it's just a great example of something that, because the department, now there are only 9 people in the CS department at MUD because we're a tiny place, because they decided to do it, they did it. The second one I want to tell you about is a recent revision to our core curriculum. Now, at Harvey Mudd College, every student takes their first 3 semesters is devoted to what's called the core, and it is a broad and deep exposure to math, physics, chemistry, biology, computer science, engineering, and humanities, social sciences, and the arts. And it is an amazingly broad and intense experience. One of the things we realized was that because of the way our core was structured, when our students arrived, there was almost no way that they could take an elective course in their first year. And one of the things we heard when we did our strategic planning during my first year at Harvard Mudd College was from students that they really wanted, they would arrive speaking a foreign language or playing a musical instrument, and they really wanted the opportunity to have an elective in their first year so that they would be able to continue that interest or explore something else. And our faculty, about 3.5 years ago, started working on revising the core curriculum. And this was we have about 85 faculty, and I think at least 80 of the faculty were involved in one way or another. And they have really almost completely restructured the core to, one, provide more electivities, two, to provide more opportunities for interdisciplinary learning, and three, to provide an additional emphasis on writing. Now, our students, even though they're majoring in some area of science or engineering, they take 30% of their credit in humanities, social sciences, and the arts. And of course, they do a lot of writing in those areas. But our faculty had noticed that their ability to write in, say, economics or literature did not necessarily carry into an ability to write physics or engineering or computer science. And so our faculty decided that the issue was really that they needed to have more writing assignments in the technical classes. But what they realized also is that our faculty in science and engineering don't know how to teach writing. And so even if they gave a writing assignment, they didn't know how to give the appropriate feedback to students on how to improve their writing. And so by the end of the summer, 40% of our faculty in science and engineering will have been trained to teach writing. They're going to writing workshops and learning to teach writing. And so what happens now is, and this is the first year we had this happen for every incoming student, every incoming student takes a course called RIT1, that's WRIT1, that is taught by a faculty member from across the college, and it's a 7-week course with an 8-to-1 ratio of student to faculty member, and we have faculty from every single department teaching this. And, of course, what this means is that our faculty are not just teaching this introduction to writing, they're able to teach, to give writing assignments and give feedback throughout the curriculum. So we are extraordinarily excited about this. The final one that I want to tell you about is the fact that we have just recruited a new vice president for advancement. His name is Dan Macaluso, and comes to us previous at Emory University and before that at UT Austin, before that at Penn State University. And I have to say, when I talk about raising visibility and raising resources, managing to attract somebody like Dan to Harvey Mudd College is just an amazing thing. And so I am super excited. And, you know, I can tell you that when he was thinking about where he was going to go, he never imagined he'd go to a tiny college like us. And when he came for the on-campus visit and met our students and faculty and staff, he fell in love. And, you know, I've obviously fallen in love, too, as pretty much anybody else who spends time about Harvey Mudd College does. And just to see somebody with so much talent and so much energy, you know, completely shift what they expected to do in terms of, you know, I think he was expecting to be vice president of advancement at a major research university. And to have him choose to come here, I think is just phenomenal.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you're coming to your sort of the end of your first 5 years and you're going to enter into another term of 5 years. So what do you hope to accomplish in the next 5 years?
One of them is to increase the number of African-American Hispanic students, and that's something, you know, that we're working on really hard. One of the other benefits from the revision to the core curriculum is that it will allow us to admit some students who are equally bright and hardworking to the ones we have already, but a little bit less well-prepared. One of the issues about coming to MUD has been that if you didn't get great math and science teaching in high school, there's just no way you would survive here. And so we are doing a new summer institute program this year together with a series of partner courses that will go on throughout the year to help students who are a little bit less well-prepared, as well as workshops and other things, for the first year and a half that the students are here. And we think this will really help a lot. It is going to be launched this summer, so we're very excited about this. We're also, together with this goal, we're really trying to figure out how we can have more impact in the Los Angeles area for students from underrepresented groups. And so this summer, together with Claremont Graduate University and the Long Beach School District, we're going to be launching a program called the Claremont Summer Math Collaborative, where we'll be bringing probably about 25 African-American boys at the end of eighth grade for a math camp, and have coaching for them throughout the school year, and then bring them back the next summer for another math camp, and with the goal that every single one of these students, by the time they're in 12th grade, will be taking AP Calculus. The current situation is there might be one African-American male taking AP Calculus in the whole Long Beach School District these days. So we're hoping to really have an effect there. I've also started an initiative called the President's Circle of African-American Advisors. Now, you might wonder why I'm focusing on African-Americans, and that's because that is the group with whom we do the worst. We're typically about 2% African-American, whereas the demographic in the United States is 13% African-American. We're about 7 or 8% for Hispanic, who the demographics is, again, about 13% Hispanic. So African-Americans are, you know, we're really focusing now for the next couple of years. And I started this circle of advisors of very prominent African-Americans from across the country who have had great careers related to science or engineering. And I think that by getting their feedback on what we're doing and getting them to understand how serious we are about addressing this, we will raise our visibility within the African-American community, and that will help too. So then in terms of visibility, I already mentioned Dan Macaluso, which is, he's been with us for, this is his 24th day, March 24th, and I just am so excited about this opportunity for us to work together. We're also working hard recruiting new members for our Board of Trustees. And then the next thing I would say is, I don't know if you saw, but PayScale, which is an organization that has been studying the salaries of graduates from about 1,000 institutions across the United States. And this year we were ranked the highest for mid-career salaries compared to anyone. And I think of the things that increased our visibility this year, that was probably the biggest one. So those are the main things that we're going to be focusing on. Of course, we'll also be building our new teaching and learning building, which is going to be extraordinarily exciting. And just continuing to do everything we can to be the best undergraduate science and engineering education on the face of the earth.
Well, sounds like you've got a great start, and you're continuing that sort of journey. And I know that one of the first things you did on becoming president of Harvey Mudd is you actually laid out a strategic plan. So it looks like you're exceeding the objectives of your strategic plan.
No, I'd say we're just focusing on the objectives in the strategic plan. You know, the six themes are innovation, impact, and leadership in science and engineering education. The second one is emphasis on interdisciplinary and experiential learning. Third one is excellence and diversity at all levels. The fourth one is nurturing and supporting the whole person. And so, you know, you can see what we've been doing with our core curriculum revision and efforts in diversity, you know, really supporting these. The fifth one is global engagement and informed contributions to society. And the sixth one is raising the infrastructure and resources to match the level of excellence to which we aspire. So we're just focused on those themes, and we're moving ahead as fast as we possibly can.
Now, more broadly then, where do you see the whole education sector heading?
You know, the thing I continue to focus on, at least in the United States, is that we do extremely well, I think, in our large research universities in terms of the research that we do and to a large extent graduate education. And I think, at least in science and engineering, we don't put nearly enough attention to the undergraduate education of people in those fields. And, you know, it's all a question of how you weigh the value of somebody who is doing a great job of teaching or creating a learning community for the students that they're working with versus somebody who's a great researcher. And there just needs to be a better balance there. And, you know, one of the things I continue to stress, and it's one of the reasons I really am proud to be president at Harvey Mudd College, is I think we are a great example of a place that gets the balance right.
And what needs to be fixed in education, and how do you propose this be done?
I would say for K-12 education, that's a more complicated problem. It's one I spend a lot of time on. And for that one, I think the biggest issue was really both in giving the teachers the support, the recognition, and the training that they need, and providing salaries that can attract and retain really good teachers. So, you know, that's for K-12, I would say that is the primary objective, and, you know, one that a number of organizations are working really hard on. But I think we still have a long way to go. In terms of, you know, undergraduate education, I would say the biggest thing is really helping our faculty become better teachers. And, you know, most faculty who are teaching would like to succeed in that, but there's just not enough emphasis on, you know, helping faculty develop in those areas. And one of the things that we've done within our math department is start a teaching postdoc program where new faculty come here for 2 years or 3 years after their PhD, and they're very heavily mentored in terms of developing their teaching abilities. Some graduate programs have good initiatives in place to provide better support for PhD students to become better teachers, but, you know, I really think this needs a lot more attention. There's also a fair amount of work, for instance, the University of British Columbia at the Carl Wieman Center for Innovation and Education. They're really looking at how do you help an entire department decide to transform the educational experience for the students taking its courses. And so I think there's a lot of work going on in this direction, and, you know, I just think we need to do even more of it.
Now, can you describe, one, two, or three of your board positions and your most difficult challenges and opportunities with each role, and how the strategic goals of those organizations will be achieved?
So let me start with the Anita Borg Institute for Women in Technology. That's the organization that runs the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing that I talked about. And this is the board that I am going off. It's an amazing organization. Having been on it right from the very beginning, and have seen all the issues about scaling. So, you know, the Hopper Conference used to be about 400 people. It'll be, 2,500 or 3,000 people in Portland. And they did a Hopper Conference in India, the first international Hopper Conference last December. They were expecting 400 attendees. They had over 600. It's just clear that the demand for what this organization does, which is all about including, retaining, and advancing women in technology careers, and in looking at the ways that technology can improve the lives of women around the world. So this is an organization that has, it's growing. The demand for its programs and the number of companies that want to be involved has been growing very steadily over the last several years. And I think, you know, the huge thing for them is to make it through that scaling transition. And they've got a great board. I mean, it's like the who's who of technology leaders in both industry and academia. They've got a fabulous CEO, Kelly Whitney, and they've got fabulous staff as well. So it's challenging to go through this, as any startup knows. It's challenging to go through this scale-up transition, but I just have complete confidence that they're going to succeed enormously. I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful organization, and I will miss being on the board a great deal, but I know that I will be continuing to go to the Hopper Conference and be engaged in other kinds of ways, and we'll still be in touch with the people that, know, I truly love and admire at that organization. The second one I'll talk about briefly is the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute at Berkeley. It's the preeminent research center for mathematics around the world. There are other very good ones elsewhere, like, for instance, the Fields Institute in Toronto, and BERS, the Banff, I won't get this right, the Banff Institute for Research Symposia is another great mathematics research institute, and Institute for Mathematics and Applications is also a really good one. But I think almost everyone would say that the one that has really led the way and has still the most impact and so on is MSRI in Berkeley. And the interesting transition that they're going through is they just were renewed for another 5-year grant from the National Science Foundation and, you know, saw a significant increase in their budget as well. But the reality is that if we want to be sure that that institute will be there 100 years from now, they need to start building a private endowment. Because you just cannot guarantee that, you know, 50 years from now, the National Science Foundation will still think it's important to have mathematical research centers. And so their big thing is they have a challenge grant from Jim Simons and of $10 million. And so their big thing is to, you know, is to raise the other half of that. So they're entering into that, you know, fundraising. I mean, it's not that they hadn't started fundraising. They have done a lot in fundraising from private donors over the last 10 to 15 years. But that's really the big transition facing them, is how to make them, how to be successful in fundraising. And then the final one that I'll talk about is Math for America. Math for America is an organization that was founded by Jim Simons in New York in order to attract very talented people who are very talented in mathematics and have, you know, the people and organizational skills to become great high school teachers and help them, you know, get their master's degree in education and mentor them and support them and give them an additional stipend in exchange for professional development for their first 4 years in the profession. And I'm one of the founders of the Math for America Los Angeles Initiative. There are now about 7 sites across the country that are doing similar things. For the national board on which I serve, I think our really big thing right now is we love this Teaching Fellows program, and I think we all think it's very important. But we're now moving to focus in addition or even more on teachers who are ready in the profession and who are doing well but could use a lot more support and leverage. And so most of the sites are launching Master Teacher programs to work with teachers who've been teaching in high school for at least 4 years. And I think it's very interesting to see this transition. Math for America has been running for about 7 years in New York City, and so, you know, it's had a very small number of teachers in the first cohort, but they're now seeing that, you know, teachers who are in their fifth year and beyond are forming a large part of their master teacher program, and it's just very exciting to see this sort of wave of really helping teachers be successful and provide them with a community, provide them with continuing professional development as well as recognition. So I think the big thing for Math for America is, you know, continuing to grow and scale, but also making this transition to the Master Teacher Program.
No, Maria, I think this is pretty clear to the audience. You know, you do so much in terms of societal contributions, and a lot of that is volunteer work. So where do you see volunteerism in the future, and what are your recommendations for the audience?
I think for many people, the work that you do as a volunteer is some of the most exciting things you do with your life. And I tell my students at all ages, you know, it's never too soon to start changing the world. And the easiest way to do it initially at the early stages of your career is as a volunteer. So, you know, it's a wonderful way to connect with other people who care about similar issues and to leverage each other in terms of, achieving things you want to have happen. So, you know, I'm a huge believer in getting involved as a volunteer early and keeping on doing it. So just yesterday I was gave a couple of classes in the Merman School for Gifted Children. And, of course, I was talking a bit about computer science and art and math and my career and so on, and then doing some great math problems with them. And, you know, I was just remembering that the first time I started doing things in the schools around math education was when I was 17 years old. And, you know, I've been in the schools on and off throughout my career, and it's one of the things that has given me some of the most pleasure. So, you know, I just think it's one of these things. It's incredibly inspirational. inspirational to work with others on things that you think matter.
Now, can you then make your predictions for the future and how we can best prepare?
Well, I mean, the first one is, none of these are going to be surprising in the least. The first one is the importance of innovation. I mean, I just think innovation was important 10 years ago, it was important 20 years ago, and it's even more important today. And so, you know, one of the things we're thinking a lot about is how do we best educate our students to make them more successful as innovators, while they're here once they graduate. The second one is obviously the global economy. I mean, it's just so obvious over the last few years how interconnected we all are and how much we need everybody, whether it's faculty members or students or industry leaders or industry professionals, to be thinking about things in a global context, because it's just what reality is. And the final one, and, you know, this is, you know, we're obviously in the middle of it right now, but the extent of which information technology is changing the world. And, of course, you know, the last couple of months in terms of what has been going on in the Middle East and the Arab world is just, it's both wonderful and awful in a wide variety of different ways. And I think we have to be prepared for the fact that information technology, you know, we talk about, you know, what an impact it had over the last 50 years. Well, it's going to have an even bigger impact over the next 50 years. And I think we need to realize that our profession, our area of expertise is incredibly important to the world. And we also need to recognize that because of that, it comes with extra responsibility. You know, it's not enough just to be a computer scientist. You need to understand things about economics, politics, the developing world, and so on, because it's all tied together.
Maria, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables, and you sort of then sort of ask yourself, what kind of question should I have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Okay, well, my three questions are, why do I love being at Harvey Mudd College? What makes me excited about being a computer scientist, and what have I learned recently? So I'm going to answer these really quickly since we're almost out of time. I love being at Harvey Mudd College because it's being part of a learning community that is really committed to everyone's success and to innovation and to, you know, really looking at outcomes and being very honest about what works and doesn't work. And that is just an inspirational experience every day. Now, I'm excited about being a computer scientist because of how important it is in the world and how much difference it's going to make, how we implement information technology across a huge variety of areas over the coming, you know, couple of decades. And, you know, I feel like being a computer scientist is having the levers for change at my fingertips. And then just closing with what I learned recently, I want to close with a very brief story. I am very physically challenged in the sense that I'm very uncoordinated. And so I hate learning anything that is physically challenging. And I went to visit a friend called Lenny in Sun Valley, and he arranged for me to take skiing lessons. Now, I would never have chosen this for myself because, you know, I hate taking lessons on things that are hard for me to learn. But nevertheless, he did, and I took them because I didn't want to argue with him. And on the second day of my skiing lessons, the instructor said, you know, I've already told you these four things you need to do. Try this one more, which is, as you're coming out of your turn, sort of throw yourself downhill a little bit. And, of course, this sounds very scary, but I did it. And all of a sudden, I went from being a really crummy intermediate skier to being a pretty good intermediate skier with that one thing. So, you know, the part that I'm really thinking about out of this is, you know, where else in my life is there that other thing that somebody could teach me that would make my life so much better and make me so much more effective? So it's never too late to learn.
Kind of reminds me of our first interview, or one of the initial two interviews anyways, where you talked about taking up skateboarding. So
indeed. Yeah, well, so the fact that I'm terrified of learning these physical things, it doesn't actually stop me from doing it.
Well, Maria, you know, I really enjoyed this interview today, and I know your schedule is very demanding, and we're indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your substantial insights and wisdom with our audience.
And thank you, Stephen. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Maria Clave, distinguished, celebrated, world-renowned computer scientist, president of Harvey Mudd College, board director of Microsoft Corporation, speaker at the World CIO Forum, past dean of engineering and professor of computer science at Princeton University, former vice president and dean of science at UBC in Canada.